Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. Today's episode is a conversation with Neil Richmond, member of the Irish Parliament, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown, and his party's spokesman for European affairs. He talks about his experience as one of the four delegates from the Irish Parliament to the plenary of the Conference on the Future of Europe. As you will hear, Neil is at times quite critical of the conference process, but on the whole, he regards it as a very positive experience. Oh, and before we start, one technical note. We apologize for an unidentified beeping noise at the beginning of the recording. It goes away after about a minute, so please don't let that put you off listening to this conversation with Neil Richmond, TD. We're here in conversation with Neil Richmond, who's the TD for Dublin Rathdown. But Neil has had a really unusual career for a TD in that he spent a lot of time dealing with European issues, and so he has quite exceptional knowledge of European affairs. You want to say a few words about that, Neil, just as a way of introduction?
Yeah, I suppose it all goes back to when I was an undergrad. I merely had an interest in the kind of the history of the European movement, the European process. I got involved in politics at the same time. I joined Fine Gael, which is obviously a very pro-European party, became one of the party's representatives to the youth of the European People's Party alongside folks like Leo Varadkar and Lucinda Creighton. Then when I moved on, I did my master's under Bridget Laffin in UCD, and that was all on the European political party system. And moving on from that, I went to work initially as a stagiaire for the European People's Party in Brussels, stayed on and worked as a parliamentary assistant to Gay Mitchell, the then MEP, before coming home and working in politics. And when I was elected to the county council. But whilst I was a county councillor, I started a job for European Movement Ireland here as a projects manager, worked there for about 3.5 years. And then as a councillor, I was appointed to the Irish delegation to the Committee of the Regions, which I think it's always the little European institution that can and perhaps often gets forgotten about. With European Movement Ireland, would have engaged with a lot of the European institutions. We were been working at the same time with the Irish presidency of the Council of the EU, lots of other areas in that regard. Then I was on the Committee of the Regions until I became a senator in 2016. And when I was elected to the Senate, I was appointed the party's European Affairs spokesperson in the Senate. Have sat on the Oireachtas Committee for European Affairs ever since, both as a senator and as a TD. And whilst a senator, I was actually also the chair of the Brexit Committee that was temporarily set up after that delightful occurrence. And I still maintain I'm one of the Fine Gael delegates to the European People's Party. And then I've just finished off being one of the four Oireachtas delegates to the Conference on the Future of Europe.
Right. And that's an excellent segue. We're going to be talking about the Conference on the Future of Europe. Can you tell me who were the other representatives of the Oireachtas?
So there's four Oireachtas delegates. There was myself, Niamh Smith, TD from Fianna Fáil and Cavan Monaghan, Rory O'Murhu, TD from Sinn Féin in Louth, and Alice Mary Higgins, the independent senator from the NUI panel. There was obviously then the citizens delegate, which was Noel O'Connell. And then there was eight from the citizens panels who were delegated at various situations. Was there eight or two? I only met two at the process of it. And then obviously Minister Byrne would have been at all the plenaries, and there would have been regular appearances from other ministers throughout as well. Pippa Hackett spoke, Josefa Madigan, my constituency colleague, and others.
Okay, so the whole idea was to have a cross-party representation for each member state. Now this, give us a sense, so you were a member of the conference plenary, yeah. Which is kind of the highest deliberating body, and all of these other kind of inputs. There are kind of other debating forums which came up with ideas, and they were all input into the plenary. So the plenary is supposed to take all of these ideas and kind of synthesize them. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea was to get out amongst the citizens, which very noble and very important, and to really get the feel of what the citizens believed were the important issues facing Europe, and then to try and translate the issues that were raised into potential action or actions over various policy areas. So that was definitely the idea. But the problem with the Conference of Future Europe, which I think was a worthwhile exercise and was very glad to be part of it, and I think it did some good work, is there was no blueprint. It was kind of a little bit, the pandemic played a serious part in it. There was a little bit of making it up as you went along in terms of the structure, and then there was a rush deadline to get it done by the end of the French presidency. And then from a practical point of view, having to go to Strasbourg four times in the space of 2 months for 4 days over the weekend, it's a little bit unrealistic. So it became a lot more of a chore than it should have been. And I think that could have been come down if they actually had a defined process. But that was probably unlikely, because you always had the three institutions of the Council, Commission and Parliament fighting over who was driving this.
Okay, so just to set the scene for us. So there were, I believe, seven plenaries, but some of those were hybrids or took place online. Am I correct?
Yeah. So the first one, I didn't go to them all in person. The first one, there was quite high restrictions at the time. One or two did go, but actually getting to Strasbourg was an ordeal in terms of PCR tests and various forms you needed to get into anything like that. It eased off by the end. You still had to wear a mask in the chamber. You needed your pass sanitaire to go to get a sandwich somewhere nearby. But, the pandemic really had an impact on how easy it was. And the problem with these, doing them by hybrid was okay, but it wasn't like, it was far more productive being there, of course, like anything. With the nature of, you needed to be able to speak to people in the margins. You needed to be able to speak to people over coffee. You needed to get a sense what other like-minded individuals were pushing, be it politically or geographically. So the first one I attended was last summer, nearly a year ago, and that was hybrid. And the problem was there was an awful lot of set piece speeches. And then it came, all of a sudden we got added onto us, they decided we'd go into working groups. So there were seven working groups on seven different themes, which were very interesting. But everyone just came into the working groups and made the same speeches. And the politicians were really guilty of this. And there was actually a really good delegate. I think she was Danish. She was one of the citizens delegates on my working group, which is the economy and jobs and social justice. And in flawless English, really blunt English, none of you are addressing the issues that we've raised. Have any of you actually read the documents? I'm fairly sure half the people who'd spoken hadn't read the documents at this stage. The documents were coming out late. We were getting them maybe at 1 a.m. the day before. It was chaotic. And it felt to me that a lot of it was just, because we were meeting in Strasbourg, our first meetings we had Thursday night. And generally they were the Thursday night of a Strasbourg week of the European Parliament. So you would have all the MEPs, who were a large chunk of the delegates, were down there. A lot of the commissioners would have been down there anyway, members of the council. It felt like the arguments of the week that had just been had in Strasbourg kicked on into the session. And there wasn't much structure given. And therefore, a lot of the recommendations coming from the citizens were quite loose. And certainly one of the things that I found had a huge impact was when the war broke out, the latest iteration of the war in Ukraine, that focused minds, and a lot of the grandstanding, single transferable speeches stopped and people started addressing the issues a bit better, which gave a bit of credibility. I think the session we had closest to Russia's date to the latest invasion, that was one I found the most productive. We actually rendered out what are the challenges in terms of food security, energy security, dealing with migration and refugees. They were now being presented in such a volume, potentially in such a volume, talking about Europe and the world and security and defence when there's a war on Europe's border, on the EU's border, it made it a lot easier. But even still, the conference was really useful, but there was huge celebration at the end. But we accepted all the recommendations. We didn't vote on anything, So 50-odd recommendations have now gone to the council. Maybe there's going to be a convention. What are they going to do with it? And I think a lot of it was just too much of a blank page. It should have been resolved at first that this is the structure. We're going to take feedback from citizens. Like halfway through the process in my committee, in my working group, they decided on a traffic light system, red for something that either wasn't applicable or was being, amber if it was being done already, or green if that's a recommendation we could make. And then like old battles came up quite quickly. Like, so I made a speech and my intervention and like a fairly roundly attacked by an Italian trade unionist because it was all about Ireland's low corporation tax. And I was like, had this debate. That wasn't actually relevant to what I spoke to at all. But it was the same then when we finally made the recommendations, there was a huge last minute fuss about coming from Eurosceptic members in Central and Eastern Europe. So like, I'm kind of going like, you just had this round in the European Parliament. This is perennial discussion. But the themes that the citizens are recommending, like it was a really good tool in seeing it. What is the huge issue? But then I heard the same old tired responses that, oh, well, the EU needs to communicate itself better. Obviously it does. We need a European television station, or we need to take ads out in papers. And go like, I've been talking about that for 20 years. You know, these aren't great breakthrough ideas. There were some really radical suggestions, like a European-wide minimum wage, really radical, but it's not really practical. Like, what's a European minimum wage going to look like? In Ireland, we're going to move to 12.50. In Denmark, it's 18 euro. Are you going to tell an employer in Bulgaria that to pay all their workers 18 euro an hour? Like, it's just not realistic when a cup of coffee is probably 60 cent there. So it was all those sort of things. It just showed the strengths and weaknesses of the European project, because there was a huge amount of enthusiasm. There was no time for populism. And you had some really good interventions from some of the more, because the delegates were really, really diverse, far more diverse than your average politician.
Now, when you say that the delegates, are you talking about the citizens? Because just to clarify for the listeners, so in the plenary, you have 108 MEPs, 108 members of national parliaments, and 108 citizens,
yeah.
and then a few people from other various institutions and civil society, etc. Is that so? About 400 people.
Yeah. And obviously, not you never had a stage where everyone was there, because a lot of people dialed in, and it certainly made the working groups difficult when you had the chair dialing in.
Oh, right.
That was quite frustrating. That
was the case with your working group?
Well, on occasion, and I'm sure there was really good reason why they had to dial in. But it meant, like, the chair's not in the room, they can't see who's indicating, and it's all approved speakers' lists. It doesn't allow for flow of debate, which is always the difficulty when you're talking about anything about EU with real-time translation. Bear in mind, we could only have meetings for 2-hour sections because we needed to give they didn't have enough translator. Everything, firstly, it had to be the room had to be de-COVIDed. Then you needed to give the translators their working break and all that. But certainly I found when the citizens as such were far more representative of society. Mm-hmm. There was equal part men and women. There was young, there was old, there was visible ethnic minorities, gay, straight. And let's be honest, the politicians, be they member state or MEPs, were pretty much middle-aged and white. I'm just at the edge of middle age. But I certainly was one of the younger parliamentarians there. And I'm by no means a young parliamentarian. But I definitely got, like, you had some really interesting ones. There was a bit of coordination between the civic society groups who had delegates who were clearly from a business group or a trade union group, and then the other institutions coming in. Like, there was a delegate from the Economic and Social Committee who had been an MEP for 25 years. So you're kind of like, oh, well, I've heard your speeches for the last 25 years. It's fine. He's in my political group. I agreed with what he was saying. And then the political groups came in very, very proactively in the politicians. So even though, like, we had EPP meetings as well as the socialists had meetings, the liberals had meetings, and some of the citizens delegates would have attended those because they happen to be affiliated to trade unions and something that's more in the broader family, which I definitely think if we had been able to do this over a 6-month period, which a much tighter agenda, all in person in Brussels or somewhere accessible rather than Strasbourg, preferably not at the weekend, you would have had a much tighter bunch of recommendations. The recommendations that are in, they're all things to all people. I think when a convention happens or the council looks at it, you could probably take a dozen of those and say there's things that are happening already. Another dozen that would require new initiatives, and another dozen that are just never going to happen and it's pie in the sky thinking. But I can't see, and one of them being, do we move from QMV to unanimity at council level? I can't see that getting unanimous agreements at a council level for obvious reasons. So look, that's in people's interests and not in their interests at all times. So it's definitely, as a process, it was nearly there. That's the thing. I wouldn't be critical of it. I think it's worth doing. And I'm very much a big believer in parliamentary democracy and representative democracy. I don't believe in direct democracy, but this form of deliberate democracy is a very useful exercise, and it's far more useful for an institution like the European Union than it would be, say, for a national member state government, because the European Union physically is, and legislatively is, just that little bit more detached from the citizen. And it's the big issue, and I particularly saw it when I was on the Committee of the Regions. How do we get this down into the region? Ireland, small government, national, small country, the national government has a much bigger role. But, you know, if you're in a country like Italy or Poland or Germany that really believes in the federal basis, and it's nearly as important what decisions made in the Reichstag as in Northwest Westphalia or somewhere like that. You know, that's how the EU actually getting out there, engaging with citizens. There was a shame it didn't get huge media coverage in Ireland, but what does from a European point of view? So this is why it's great to be able to talk to you about it, Ian. Yeah. Like it's so talking about it.
Can I drill down? The economy, the specific, because you were on that working group, right? And if I'm not mistaken, the citizens' assembly on the economy was held in Dublin.
Yeah.
Now, what was your, and did that process feed into your work in the working group in a serious way?
Yeah, no, it did. Now, in terms of my attendance in Dublin, I was invited to attend and observe, not contribute, and even observe. Like, it was over a full weekend, really just to observe the opening session. You weren't invited for the whole thing. But what we certainly got is we had the reports from the citizens that we then debated in working group, and then we debated in the plenary. So the issues that were being debated, that was driven by the citizens, which was good. That worked really, really well. The problem is politicians like myself didn't always read what the citizens had to say, or didn't engage with the citizens. Some did. Alice Mary Higgins, I must give her credit. She was very proactive on this. Whether or not she was, you know, whether or not they were making a tangible impact, it's up for debate. We'll see that when it comes out of the washer. But she was very engaged in the process. For someone like me, there was two or three areas that I had particular interest in, and I just wanted to make sure that they were included, or that they were continuously referred to, and that some of the more extreme things, to be honest, that probably more left-wing things, didn't make it to the final report. And, you know, you didn't have a, it was all done by consensus basis, take the recommendations, and then really it's just about prioritizing from the citizens. And even then you had, which is why I was quite critical that we had the working group. There was no need to split into working groups, because every recommendation, even European democracy or Europe in the world, they all had references to kind of key areas: climate emergency, competence of health in light of the pandemic, housing and standard of living. And this is really before the cost of living issues started to kick in. So there, we could have easily done this with just plenary sessions and actually got citizens to feed in to make these recommendations to the plenary. If we had 20 good recommendations into the plenary and debated each of them over 3 or 4 weeks and rendered them down to key actions about what was agreeable, and then sent it off to the council with a very, very clear recommendation. Whereas the recommendations aren't clear. Like, the council could easily get the report, say thanks very much, and pretend to do stuff with this if they wanted to. I'm not being cynical. I've no doubt that they will take it on board. But the results are so broad that it's very hard not to fulfill the aspirations or the mandate of the conference.
Do you think your impression was that the, or not your impression, your recollection is that but basically all of the recommendations that came out of Dublin ended up getting filtered through the plenary and more or less
the working adopted. Group first and then the plenary.
So in the working group, but the working group didn't change them very much.
No.
And then they went to the plenary and then they were just kind of adopted through. So it sounds like that there wasn't actually that much kind of sifting and filtering going on in the conference itself.
Well, definitely what I found in the working group, it was all about bringing it together in sort of a common language and then preparing action points. Like, the reports that were presented to the plenary were just accepted. let's be frank. There was good discussion about them, but as I said, half the speeches, including at working group as well as plenary, actually had nothing to do with the recommendations that were presented. And that's not a criticism of the conference. That's what was a criticism of my own vocation. Like, that's what we do. But perhaps then it was because the remit was so broad that because the recommendations were so varied, if you're a politician, you could foist in whatever you wanted to talk about. So it definitely was open to abuse that made for, but in terms of actually getting tangible work, like everyone was a winner out of this process. There was no losers. And I'm not saying that there had to be losers, but I just think what has come out of it is probably too broad. Will it lead to treaty change? Will it not lead to treaty change? Like, I would hope that the recommendation would have been quite clear that we either do or do not need treaty change because we need to do these 10 things, some of which are being done already, but need to be done slightly differently or more efficiently. I still think there is scope for that, but I just feel it could get watered down by the council, or it could get pulled into whatever the weekly argument is in the European Parliament, like references to competitiveness and all these other things.
So, I mean, I think I'm perhaps been even around a little bit longer than you. So I remember the Convention on the Future of Europe had a very specific mandate to actually rewrite the treaties. And that was a very thorough process. Not much citizen involvement, but it involved a lot of national parliamentarians as well as MEPs, and by the standard of whether you think that their actual deliberation went on and actually produced something that was genuinely kind of thoughtful and new, I think that there's something to be said for that process. Whereas this is kind of just a this whole process takes place before the treaty, the arguments about before an intergovernmental conference on treaty change even starts, yeah. Right? So it's just basically a laundry list of recommendations that would require treaty change, some of which would require just EU legislation, some of which wouldn't even require that, probably just soft law or.
I think certainly with this process, this was kind of the part of the problem. They all said we need to talk about the future Europe, but no one said what that future requires. So you talk about the convention, it's quite clear we need to redo the treaties. Treaties mightn't change out of this, probably won't change. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. As an exercise in consultative democracy, as an exercise in bringing the union closer to the citizens, I thought it was really good. However, in terms of an exercise that brings a very defined outcoming of it, you know, because it had never been done before, I would have loved to have been in the room when it was decided that this is going to happen and just be able to set out, okay, well, this is the agenda and this is there needed to be quite clear, you know. See, it comes by who was driving the need for this. Was it just Emmanuel Macron, not to personalize it? Was it the parliament? And then it became a turf war between the three institutions and the rotating presidency. I thought there was huge scope if you went in and go like, right, we can get a result out of this that may or may not need treaty change, but we're going to go to this effort. We need to make this a lot more productive for the amount of time and effort and money that's going to go into it.
Here's a question for you. Going back a couple of years, there was a big debate. The debate was over whether there should be one person who's the overall chair of the Conference on the Future of Europe. And one name that was mentioned was Guy Verhofstadt, and a lot of people objected to that name. But there are other names like Alex Stubb or Helle Thorning-Schmidt, you know, someone with some kind of gravitas and is well known across Europe. Do you think that would have made a difference having someone like Giscard d'Estaing had that role in the Convention on the Future of Europe? Do you think it would have made a difference?
Depends who the person was, because Guy Verhofstadt was one of the three chairs, and he very much tried to push his own agenda, and even his kind of review of what was agreed made it sound like a fait accompli that we're changing everything, like it was jumped on by the Daily Express, and rightly so. But Clement Beaune, the French European Affairs Minister, had a particular interest, but could have been just a different European Affairs Minister that maybe had come and gone. And then, you know, the commissioner, the lady from Croatia, sorry, I'm not going to try and butcher her name with a pronunciation. It wasn't clear, like they all were kind of coming at it from different angles. Yeah, a singular chair who could have facilitated and been very stern. One of the really powerful people in the whole process was Richard Corbett, the former British MEP, who as a part of the secretariat, he really drove a lot of it. I would have liked to see a singular independent chair that perhaps hadn't been, that was involved in the European process, had a great working knowledge, but wasn't overly exposed to it. I'm going to clarify what I mean by that. A former head of state, maybe someone like Donald Tusk, who, well known in European circles, had been a president of the European Council, had chaired the European People's Party. Maybe someone in another era like John Bruton, who obviously was on the convention previously, well regarded, got the European state of play, but wasn't still completely immersed in the politics of the Schuman bubble of the weekly basis, and wasn't looking for the perennial battle of what Europe means. Alex Stubb was an MEP for a long time. Guy Verhofstadt still is. You know, having someone who knew exactly, who could dedicate the time to it, had a great working knowledge of the European institutions, but had also been a prominent national parliamentarian, and perhaps was more prominent as a national parliamentarian. And this is the real segue. We had the Congress of the European People's Party there a couple of weeks ago. I didn't go, but I'd been at the previous one. I've been at loads of them. And it's all about the European election results, which is great. But there has to be a balance that, well, we also need to boost our members of the Commission and the Council, and we do that through member state elections as well. And it's a real issue that even when you're electing the vice presidents, it's all commissioners and MEPs. Where is the national state implementation? And, you know, if you believe in subsidiarity, surely you're trying to push that into the argument a bit more. And I just felt that far too much of this conference, you had lots of opinions from citizens, but it was just taken into the European debate. There needed to be a twin track and have, like, member state parliamentarians who weren't even getting speaking time some of the weekends. And as I said, you had the same people from the European Parliament saying the same speeches that they're always saying and having the same row. And it gets very personal. And it's clear that they've had a row at their econ meeting on Tuesday in Brussels or whatever. And they're just carrying it over. And I kind of lost patience with that because, as being the most, probably most pro-European politician in the Oireachtas, I still get frustrated that. And it's just, like, it's politicians of all bent, and not just politicians, but officials. A lot of the people who kind of commentated on the conference, it was like, you know, this is all about bringing Europe back to the citizens. If the citizens demand action that requires treaty change, then the politicians respond to that in a measured way. The citizens gave lots of proposals, but they weren't given the guidance. And I just felt that in some cases, the citizens were used as a buffer to allow for a debate to continue, or citizens were used to give legitimacy to the continuation of a debate that really was quite alien to the concerns they were bringing up. I think it was a really good process. It's worth doing again, but I'd love to do it more efficiently. How much of that inefficiency was driven by the pandemic? A good chunk, and that has to be acknowledged. Will there be something good that comes out of this? Absolutely. I, going into it, was reluctant to see treaty change, not just because the old Irish hesitancy of, well, can we pass a referendum on the back of this? But now I'm kind of like, well, if we need to prove that we actually did some work here and have made some real decisions, then perhaps we do need treaty change. And I think that's something that would be worth pursuing. And I think a lot of citizens who fed into us would like to see clear action, because a lot of them were asking for things, as I said, that are happening already. And I was like, well, if they're not seeing the action, is it going to require a treaty change and a move around of competence with regard to health for them to actually feel like this is happening? Because there's only so many times that the EU can trumpet getting rid of roaming charges and having a universal phone charger as being the great achievement of what is an amazing achievement in itself.
But I had a question. It's on the tip of my tongue. I was going to clarify for the listeners that the conference was supposed to start in May of 2020, and it got delayed by the pandemic, and then you had these two major disasters that happened during the process. One is the pandemic, and the next is the war, and so it's. So a process that was kind of, I mean, it was supposed to be open-ended, right? It was supposed to allow citizens to express their views about the future of Europe without preconditions, without, you know, giving them any parameters. And I think that you are being somewhat critical of that, because, and that's a, that meant that it was going to be unfocused. And then you had these major galvanizing events that that had the effect of giving it at least some focus. So Next Generation EU, how did that figure in the, because that was Next Generation EU is kind of the EU's budgetary response to the pandemic. How did that figure in the deliberations of the conference?
It figured consistently and constantly, but it was very rarely referred to by name. And this is, I suppose, kind of goes to the concept. Yet all these MEPs and ministers and commissioners and national state parliamentarians debating about Next Generation EU, they never took the time to explain what Next Generation EU is. And it kind of goes back that a lot of the requests coming in, and, you know, there were things that the EU were doing, and lots of requests for the EU to spend a lot of money. And that's fairly obvious. You know, it doesn't have a fundraising capacity in terms of, you don't have an EU tax at this stage, so you can't ask for an EU tax cut. So you ask for the EU to spend more money. No one was asking for the EU to spend less money on anything. And they were all good ideas that required more money on spending. But then obviously the decision for the politicians is, well, you don't have infinite amounts of money, so how do you spend it and how you prioritize it? So like the notion of setting up a European television channel, I just really couldn't see how that was important, as opposed to having a facility to provide funding for industries that have been impacted by war or Brexit or whatever it was. And that was a real battle for me, is, as I mentioned, it's addressing the EU jargon, the Schuman jargon, and translating into what that actually means in real life. And this is a perennial criticism I have of not the EU in itself, but those involved in it, is that they talk about making the EU more accessible, but they deliberately continue to speak in insider language. The EU has its own language laced with acronyms that's not accessible to the outside world. EU is doing so many amazing things that benefit people's lives, but are having the macro argument at a distance rather than demonstrating. And they talk a great game. You know, we want to show people what's happening in their back, in their backyards, and how this is impacting. But if you're going to just run around like the EU is just spending all this money here, then all you're going to get is, well, we want more money or we want different money. But if you're actually going to talk about the EU is making this a lot more easier, and this is how it makes your lives better, that's hard work. And it was a lost opportunity in this conference. So Next Generation EU was constant. There wasn't a debate about it as such. There were people acknowledging that this is a new departure that has been brought about. And one thing, and you mentioned the two sort of crisis points that defined a lot of discussion in folks' minds in terms of the pandemic and the war in Ukraine, like, never let a good crisis be wasted. This is an opportunity to look at how what the EU has done over the last 2 years that has been really good in terms of vaccine procurement compared to PPE procurement. That was when the EU got its house in order, having EU funds, having being able to go on the bonds markets, all these sort of things that the EU supposedly could never do, but did it. You know, Next Generation EU in itself. And go like, well, the EU has moved into a better place. The EU is no longer, we don't have the UK anymore in the discussion. So what can we do that the UK weren't allowing us to do previously, or, you know, was too cumbersome? Equally, when it comes to the war in Ukraine, the EU has done a lot good, but it shows where its slowness is, and it shows where if there's differences of opinion, that it can just stop certain work happening, as opposed to, well, how do we get around this, or how do we allow, you know, not to get into the whole debate about a two-speed Europe or something like that, or the rotating spheres of influence or whatever notion you're going at. But there was quite core areas that people want work done, that real progress can only be made at an EU level. Climate emergency. Ireland can do all it wants in the climate emergency, but if it's not doing it in partnership with the other 26 EU member states, it won't have the impact that it could have. And that was the clear ask. In terms of the economic side of things, it's you know, making people's lives a bit easier. It's no difference than the kind of the domestic debate we have on a daily basis. So certainly, I think the discussion focused heavily on, without name, focused heavily on Next Generation EU and lots of other programs without actually referring to them. Maybe that's the process, that we worry so much about the name of a program and how it can operate, but we don't go to enough lengths to educate people and debate the merits of this program in relation to how it affects daily lives of citizens in the member states.
Do you think, but when people talk about Next Generation EU, they didn't mention it by name, but they talk about the green transition, the digital transition, the things that are, that substantively are the focus of Next Generation EU.
Yeah, like particularly the green transition with, you know, and that was something that dominated digital transition. It didn't. It kind of, you know, we were talking about digital transition earlier about in relation to, say, remote working and how we deal with the pandemic. But then it was all about cybersecurity because of what's going on in Ukraine. So it was all the different thematic areas of it. But again, it came back to politicians, particularly from a European level, wanted to have the debates they were having about it anyway, as opposed to debating it in the terms of what the recommendations the citizens made. Like, there was lots of recommendations that feed into how the digital transition and the green transition worked. But I don't think there was the format to make sure that that's where the debate was focused. You know, it was very statey. You sat through a long list of 3-minute speeches. And then you had these things called blue cards where you could press in and press the button and you could make a supplementary speech. You could only do one blue card. And there was only so many blue cards. And so that's why people just went in and rattled through speeches that weren't responded to. And your later speakers didn't respond to the earlier points, you know, as opposed to the few times that I spoke, bar one, it was always through blue cards. It was challenging an assertion made or a point made. And the one time I did make my own intervention, I got challenged on corporation tax levels in Ireland.
Right. And was that one of the recommendations for greater tax harmonization?
Yeah. That's going to get shot down. But yeah, like, quite blunt. if you're an Italian trade unionist, you definitely want a singular corporation tax across the EU of 35% or something. If you're an Irish centre-right TD, you certainly don't. So look, that's the nature of it.
If that ended up in the treaty, you would assume that Ireland would veto that before it ended up in a treaty. But are you enough of a pro-European that you would campaign for that treaty if it was?
Because this is like Cain and Abel. I've never voted against the European treaty before. Don't intend to start. I couldn't see it getting into a treaty, to be honest, because it's not just Ireland. It's about 16 other member states who won't have any of that. And that's going to be the real difficulty in formulating a treaty, because you have to get unanimity, and then you have some very, very difficult member states at the moment. Like going into this process, Poland was viewed in the same light as Hungary. Coming out of this process with everything that's going on, the war in Ukraine, everyone loves Poland again, but they still have serious issues to respond to. But they've tamed and tempered their issue. They've either been browbeaten into doing it in relation to funding or anything else. Whereas the Hungarians are still fairly wild, and their interventions at the plenary was wild enough as well. Like,
really?
They were certainly, you go back to the kind of the culture war aspect of, you know, especially I wasn't on the migration working group, but that can get quite hot and heavy, you know, and needlessly so. So that was certainly something that you could see that, There was parliamentarians that said from across the political spectrum there. I was sitting beside, because of alphabetically, your man Puigdemont, the Catalan separatist. So you forget who you're sitting beside, you know, at times. Who's an MEP, who's a national parliamentarian.
So in all, it was an interesting experience, at least.
I'd definitely do it again. And I think the EU should have another conference in the future of Europe, perhaps either prior or subsequent to the next European election. It'll be great to actually have the findings of the conference be a tangible part of the debate ahead of the next European election, or lofty, not going to happen, in terms of the next Spitzen candidate election, if we still have that now that we've completely thrown that away. That's definitely something. But it would be great to have the issues that came up, whether or not we need more Europe, less Europe, whether or not we need to be putting in more funds to Next Generation EU, whether or not we need a more specific focus at European measures on climate, like we had on food with the CAP. It'd be great to debate them in a European election cycle rather than just being 27 domestic elections run differently, whereby the issue of the day locally is still the issue that's going to dominate. That's why I think the conference would be very, very useful, but it couldn't be as long as it was. It would need to be a 2 month, 3 month process done year four of every European election cycle. I think that would be really exciting and use that would be its great use. We're using this and it'll give a mandate to MEPs to debate about. And if the EPP come out hard on this aspect and they win the election, then that's going to be the dominant themes. And if the conference says there needs to be treaty change, then it's the MEPs who are obliged to push it with the council. MEPs rarely have an issue with treaty change, to be honest. It's council that the issue with the treaty change. So I don't
certainly, yeah. Well, we've managed to go through this whole conversation without talking about Brexit.
What a relief.
Where do you think we would be if the UK was still a member state of the European Union?
The UK were a really good member state of the European Union. That's the thing. They're a great ally of Ireland at a council level. Most of their MEPs, bar like the UKIP lads, were really good. I mentioned Richard Corbett there. Like, he was a brilliant MEP. And you can think about them from all political groups. Edward McMillan Scott, who was in the Tories and the Lib Dems. Lord Plum, who passed away not so long ago. Like, all these guys had a huge impact. John Hume, let's not forget, was a UK MEP. Sarah Ludford, the Lib Dem, who's a Lord now, it's still in touch with her. Like Catherine Beard or another one. These all had a really, really good impact. They chaired important committees. They drove through opinions. And I think if we had had a British influence over the Conference of the Future Europe, because I did it like when I was on the Committee of the Regions, it was pre-Brexit. Like the British members were very, very good. And like the Conservatives tended to be quite pro-European. You had Labour ones, SNP, Independents, and they were productive and proactive. And they would have definitely brought it would have been quite a supportive line of, I'd say, like, even though as four Irish delegates, we all agreed on quite a lot, there was an element of similarity in our thinking. And I think we definitely would have benefited from the support of British, of having four British delegates, a couple of British MEPs as well. Probably would have made the process a little bit more efficient. Probably would have wrestled a bit of the power struggle. And despite what some people say, I'd love if the UK rejoined the EU. And I maintain that strongly. The EU is better when the UK was in it, and the UK, I feel, was better when they were in the EU.
That's a really nice note, I think, to end on. From someone who spends a lot of his day job arguing with Brexiters and rehashing the same arguments over and over, it's refreshing to hear a positive view on British politicians. So Neil, all that's left for me to do is just to thank you very much for your time, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Sounds great.
You have been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute, in association with the Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Andre Woolgar. Thank you for listening.